Okay, good morning everybody. Welcome to this SharePoint 2010 pattern and practice session. We hope that you enjoy the tech day so far. Here's Karim Bosch. Karim is a SharePoint MVP and she's a SharePoint lead in the ING SharePoint Competence Center. She has been involved in Silverlight integration SharePoint since the beginning. Agents we target for this session are SharePoint developers and architects. So we'll give you a lot of demo, coding demos, so we'll need some coding skills. SharePoint 2010 for SharePoint 2007. And here are different topics that we are going to cover. All these topics have been experimented in our common project with ING, so that's really good practice. But there are many practices in SharePoint. We'll cover the main practices. First, I will give you an introduction to the SharePoint Pattern Practice Guidance, SPG. Next, we'll move to the main patterns covered by the SPG. I'll give you a quick overview of the useful library that SPG provides. Then Karim will move to the application lifecycle management for SharePoint 2010. Unit testing with Spectre controls, and we'll go together with the conclusion. So, let's start from the beginning. What is the SharePoint Pattern and Practice Guidance, the SPG? It's a project set up by a team from Microsoft employees and the SharePoint community. And this project provides guidance and documentation, a lot of patterns illustrated by reference implementation, a set of reusable libraries with CodeSource, including test project, discussion lists and forums, and recently, Anson Lab. So this project initially started on Codeplex, the Microsoft open source, and then later on moved to MSDN. So it's kind of official documentation. This project addressed the following challenge, coding challenge that we face when we start a real project. So for instance, testability, or can we isolate our classes in such a way that they can be tested? Flexibility, can we replace code, update code, without having to recompile the whole solution? Configuration as well, so in any application, not just SharePoint application, you need to store configuration settings somewhere. Are you going to store that in web config file or in another place? And does that scale? Logging and exception handling, or do you log your exception? Do you have a consistent logging approach across the team? And do you log pertinent information in such a way that it can be reusable by the operation team? Can it be integrated in SCOM, etc.? Maintainability, or can you maintain code that change all the time? Common challenge. And the last point was not addressed by the SPG, but that's, I think, very important. Can your code run in the cloud, because Microsoft provides an amazing product, which is beta, Office 365, where you have Link, Exchange 2010, and SharePoint Online. So today you can create code, .NET code, you can upload code to SharePoint Online, and your code will run in an isolated environment that we call the sandbox. So today you need to put this thing, so the sandbox stuff, into your governance plan. So that's super important, and all the examples that we are going to show you, well, run in the sandbox. So the SPG illustrates a set of patterns. There are many, many patterns, and we'll focus on the main patterns. The main patterns are the following, and each pattern is illustrated by a reference application. The service locator pattern, the MVP pattern, so model view presenter pattern, repository pattern, and the MVVM pattern. So all these patterns are well known by .NET developer, but less by SharePoint developer. So this is very important too. So let's illustrate the first pattern, the service locator pattern. So usually without using the service locator pattern, when you have a class and this class use another class, like for instance class A here, make use of service A and another class service B, you have a kind of a high coupling between class A and the other classes. So if you want to change service A or service B, or if you want to replace that with another implementation, for instance a mocking implementation for testing, that could be quite complex. So the usual solution is to move to the service locator pattern. So for instance here, this becomes this, and class A will have a connection to a locator class, and class A will say, hey, I want to use the class that implement this and this interface, and the locator will locate the class and will return a point to an interface. Okay, so the SPG provides an implementation for this that works in SharePoint, including in the sandbox. So let's take a look at this this pattern with a very, very simple application. So very, very simple example. I have a web part here, and I have two buttons. When I click on this button, the application calls a function in a class that make a computation, add two numbers. And here we use a service locator. This is without service locator. This is with service locator. So let's take a look at the code behind this. Very simple. So this is a SharePoint project with a web part. And in code behind, when you click on the button, so this is code behind. And we are going to call a class. This is the class. Can you see the code in the back of the room? Yes? Is it too small or that's okay? Let's zoom this. So very simple interface, iMyToolbox with one function, take two numbers and return a string. This class implement iMyToolbox. Okay, so very simple implementation. And here, in my button click code, so the first one without using the pattern, we directly call the class, we invoke the class, so we have high coupling here. And here, that's the code with the pattern. So let's move a little bit down here. So basically here, we ask a class called SharePoint Service Locator. We ask to get a pointer to this service, and then we ask the service to provide an instance of the class that implement the interface. You could have several classes that implement the interface, so you can pass a parameter to specify which one. But basically, you get a pointer to the interface, and you can call the function. Okay? Now, somewhere, you need to specify which class implement which interface and which class can be provided. So we usually do that in a feature receiver. So let's go to a feature receiver. Here we go. So in my feature receiver, I ask a pointer to the SharePoint service locator, and then the service locator will provide an instance of a service that manages configuration, in this case, a type mapping. So please, service locator, give me an instance of the class that manage type mapping, so configuration here. And you get a pointer to an object. And in this object, you can say, hey, please, anytime I want to use this interface, this class, an instance of this class must be provided. And you can get an instance when you call it, or you can get a singleton if you want. Okay, so you can have many, many associations. And everything will be stored, so this configuration will be stored in a central location on every web front end. Actually, this information will be stored in a property bag, so in the content database, and will be copied on a cache on every web front end. So that scale and that works quite well. If you want this code to run in the sandbox, you need to specify that the scope is site collection, because in the sandbox you cannot go over site collection. But when you use this, you can store your settings for the whole farm, for the web application, for the site collection, for the site if you want. Okay? So use that. That works. Huh? We know that works. And that scale. So first pattern, very easy to understand. The next very important pattern is the MVP pattern. So it's the model view presenter pattern. It's a kind of MVC, if you want. And we are kind of an MVP here, right? So
two MVPs,
yeah. Yeah, but it's not this pattern because there are two presenters. So the question is, who is the view? Okay, so like in most pattern, we have a kind of separation of concern. So we have the view, which is in charge of displaying the manipulating the user interface. We have the presenter, and we have the model. So in the model, we are going to store the data structure, including the service. And the presenter will just make the link between the view and the model. So the presenter will have a pointer to an interface on the view. So there are very low coupling between presenter and the view. The view will create an instance of the presenter, and the presenter will communicate with the model and will get information back and will store the information in the view through the interface. Okay? So it's a well-known pattern, and you can apply this pattern to many things in SharePoint. You can apply that to application page, to site page, to web part, to custom fields. Well, that's very, very important. So let's take a look at the one implementation of this this pattern. And the implementation in the SPG is the sandbox project. There are many, many projects in the SPG. We'll focus on the main reference. So let's take a look at this. So when you install SPG, you get a lot of projects, a lot of source code, and so you get something like looks like this. So let's go to the source, and you'll find this execution model and sandbox. So most solutions come with a test flavor, so with unit tests. So I encourage you to take a look at them. And the application is very easy to understand, because that's not the point. The application must be easy. And it's this one, sandbox reference application. Okay, so here we have a web part in one site, the first site, and we have two child sites, construction and maintenance. In each site, each child site, we have a list, and this web part aggregate and fetch information from the child site. So on technical point of view, that's very easy to implement. So for instance, you can use the SP site data query class, or you can use the search API if you want to aggregate data from child site. Let's take a look at the documentation. So we'll get here. So this application is well described in the SPG. Okay, so we have something like this. One home site, two child site, maintenance team site, construction team site. Two lists, estimate list, based on the same content type with a site column and a lookup that goes to the project list, and we have a web part that aggregates all information. So that's easy to understand. But now, in the implementation, first we have a SharePoint project here, and here we have the web part, which is the view. And again, in the documentation, you'll find the design, the UML design. So basically here, we have the web part, which is the view, aggregate view. It's a web part, derived from the web part class. It implements an interface, and the view will create an instance of the presenter. So in the create child controls, that's a good way to do, you create the presenter, and you pass a pointer to the view and to a service. So the presenter is made of a pointer to the view and is made of a pointer to the service. So let's take a look at the code. So here is the web part, which implements an interface, which is done here. Very, very basic. So it's a property, set site data, put a data table. And if you take a look at the create child controls, we instantiate the presenter. Let's zoom again. So here, we instantiate the presenter, we pass a pointer to the view and a pointer on the service. Actually, it's pointer to interface that this class implement. And we ask the presenter to set the data. And that's it. So the web part code is very, very simple.
Now, in the presenter, yeah, just for information, since this code ran in the sandbox, well, it's supposed to run in the sandbox, for the grid view, you have to use the grid view class, the ASP.NET grid view class. You cannot use the SP grid view because it doesn't work in the sandbox. Huh? That's the bad news, like many other controls. Now, let's move to the presenter. So here, presenter is here. The constructor takes a pointer to the view, in this case a web part, and to a service. The presenter stores the view, stores the service, and the presenter asks the service to bring data. So estimate service, get side data. You get the data and you store the data in the view, so you communicate through the interface. So this is a very good example of low coupling. And if you want, you can replace the presenter code. So you can isolate the presenter code, you can test the presenter code, and you can replace the view code and the service code with fake implementation. So that's super, super important. Yes, just for information, you will notice that in this reference application, most content type are actually created by code. So, you know, if you use code to create your content type, this gives you more flexibility. So we'll see more people moving from CAML to code in the future, I guess. That's especially important if you want to upgrade content type. You have to write code anyway. So that's probably the good practice at the content type level. Okay, the next pattern, super important, and we use that all the time, is the repository pattern. It's a well-known pattern in .NET. So here we are going to see how to use that in SharePoint. So basically, we have a client, which the client could be a website, application page, child control, event receiver, or anything. And this client business logic make call to a class called a repository that communicate with the back office. So the back office could be SharePoint list or a combination of SharePoint list and other kind of storage, Azure or SQL Server or whatever. And we exchange business entity between client business logic and the back office. So the question are, what kind of technology can we use to implement this? And how can we implement the repository? So first, what kind of technology can we use to do this? This is a very important slide. Depending on where your code runs, whether your code runs on server side or client side, you will choose different APIs. For instance, on server side, you have the server object model or the link to SharePoint API. And you see this line show the extension of the API. For instance, this illustrates the extension of the server API. You can do almost everything with the server side API. But the server-side API is weakly typed, so you don't get the column name, the field name in Visual Studio, for instance, and you don't get that at compile time. And the good practice is to get strongly typed technologies. So for the data access technology, we recommend link to SharePoint. So here, link to SharePoint only allow you to do data manipulation, so it's strongly typed. That works quite well. That scale as well. And, well, you have to be very careful with link to SharePoint because if you have to test it in anonymous mode, some technology in SharePoint don't work in anonymous mode, make sure you install some cumulative update. It initially didn't work in anonymous mode, so it didn't work in a public website. But nevertheless, know that works. And, well, we recommend it for server-side. Now, for client-side, we have two main APIs, the REST API or the Client Object Model API. So with the Client Object Model API, you can do almost everything. You see the extension of this line. But the Client Object Model is a weakly type. So it's more error-prone. So for data access technologies, we recommend the REST API, the OData API, which work quite well, which is strongly typed. But the main problem with the REST API, at least at the moment, is it doesn't work in anonymous mode. So maybe if we to wait for a cumulative update, but that's important to know right away. Because So to illustrate the repository pattern in SharePoint, because pattern is quite easy to understand, but no, how does that work in SharePoint? We have to use the following reference application, the SharePoint list reference application. So let's take a look at this this application. So the SharePoint list should be here. Again, you have a test version and a non-test version. Karine will give you more information about the test part. First, let's take a look at the data model behind this application. We have learned a lot on this this example here. So here's the data model. It's a set of SharePoint lists. For instance, here we have a parts list. A part can be used by one or several machines, and a part can be stored in one or several inventories. And a part can be provided by one or several providers. So if you want to do this, you'll have to fix some kind of many-to-many. You'll have to deal with many-to-manys. So in the reference application, they show you how to do that, okay, first. So you have to implement event handlers. So they will show you the best practice. Also, you'll see this table here. So we have lookup between this one and this one. For instance, here, if you take this one, inventory location, we have a lookup between this one and this one. Okay, so an inventory location point to a part. And when you use link to SharePoint, you have reverse lookup. So when you have a class that manipulates this kind of data, you can get all the parts. Well, we can get the parts, so we can get a pointer to the parts. But when you have a part, you can get a reverse lookup. You can find all the inventory location and all the suppliers. So that's something you get with if you use link to SharePoint or if you use SPMetal, the utility that generates link to SharePoint code. So in the SPG, they will put the finger on many problems you can face, because when you have several lookups, the SPMetal tool doesn't generate a reverse lookup. That works if you have only one lookup, but not if you have several. So they show you how to fix that. So you have to know that in your project. Okay. So let's take a look at the code. First, the application. Does that work? Repository pattern. There are many parts in this application. Let's take a look at, for instance, manage machine. Let's click this. And this works in the sandbox. We have two implementations, one that runs the sandbox, another one that runs the farm. So for instance, I want to find all the machine or information about the machine number 13. Click on this. It grabs information from a SharePoint list. So in here, I want to get the parts, associated parts. So you get all the different parts. So you can get to the supplier, location, machines. You can edit, you can delete. And you can do many other things. So I encourage you to get into this application. And more important, the code. So here's the code. Most of these reference applications have a project dedicated to the data access technology. We call that the model. So in the model, you have the content type. So all the content types should be defined in this project here. And you'll find the link to SharePoint code. So this class is generated by SPMetal. So for every list, you have a dedicated class. For instance, here, for each list, you have a class. So a property, departments. For instance, here, we have parts. So this return an entity list of parts. And a part is a kind of business entity. So that's well known by SharePoint 2010 developer. But the repository is in another project. So the project is this one, repository. So it's a kind of abstraction layer on top of your lower-level data access technology. Usually, you have to use link to SharePoint, but sometimes you have to use Camel. So you use less and less Camel, but you still need Camel sometime. So you need to wrap that up in this repository. So the class looks like this. So it's basically here a wrapper around the link for SharePoint generated code. So this is a part management repository. and implement an interface. So the interface is here. That's the good practice. Always provide an interface. And in the interface, you provide all the functions that allow you to manipulate data, read and update, etc. So if you get back to the repository implementation, we'll get something like this. Somewhere you have a data context that points to the code generated by the SPMetal. And most of the time, you get called to the SPMetal generated code. So for instance, here, let's try to find a simple example. Yeah, so get par by supplier, and here we call link to SharePoint class. So you don't have to write much code, huh? Just the repository. However, sometime you need to return DTO, that we call data transfer object. So you don't return directly entities generated by SPMetal, but you have to filter this information and put that in other class that we call DTO, data transfer object. So they show you how to do that. That's the good practice. And you will store the DTO object in your user interface, not directly the link to SharePoint code. Okay, so this is very well explained in the SPG. So for instance, here, you see, we filter that and we create DTO. Let's try to find another example. Example here, get machine by category, provide one category, called the link to SharePoint code, and return a DTO. For instance, in your link to SharePoint code, you get a title property, and this can be replaced by something which is more business-oriented, like machine name instead. So this example is super, super important. I recommend this. You can use SPMetal to generate your link to SharePoint code. That works. However, you are very tight coupled to the data structure. So if you change the data structure, you have to change your code, or you have to regenerate the link to SharePoint code. So an alternative that we still have to fully explore is the link to SharePoint DSL extension. So where you have a kind of it's a kind of entity framework. So you design your model, and this extension will generate code for you. So you specify exactly which business entities you want to use, what kind of business entity you want to use, and you map that to SharePoint. And the last version can even generate content type for you if you want. So this application has been created by a guy from Microsoft Consulting Service, Olivier Carpentier. So it's free. You can download it and you can try that out. The last pattern is the MVVM pattern, the Model View View Model pattern, which is well known by several developers. So again, good separation of concern, the view for the user interface, the model for the data access and the back office access. And between, we have the view model, which is a kind of super presenter, if you want. And any event in the view will be dispatched to the view model. The view model will communicate with the model, get update, read, etc. If any data change in the model, this will be reflected in the model and back to the view. So that works very well in rich internet application, in SharePoint or not, including in WPF. And you'll find a reference application in SharePoint, because the challenge is not an application. It should work in SharePoint, that illustrate that. It's the client application. Let's try to find that out. Client application. And basically, this client application uses the same data model as the one I showed you before. And what is nice is they provide an implementation with different technologies. You have an implementation with MVVM, using REST, or without REST. For instance, you have an implementation with the client object model, one with REST, one in AJAX with the client object model, and another one in AJAX with REST. So I recommend you to take a look at this different implementation. We'll focus on the Silverlight implementation. So when we click on this one, for instance, here, we have a Silverlight application. And here, we are going to display the list of parts. For instance, I want to find all the parts having an ID starting with SKU1. Click on Search. So you get your part. Click on a part. You get the part providers. And here, you get information about the inventory. So in the model, we are going to use the view model as a data binding class. So we are going to create a view model that will communicate with the model, and this class will be used for data binding. So let's take a look at this. So here we have two data grid plus a custom control. So let's go to the application. Here is the Civilite class. It has been removed. Yeah, the class has been deleted. Here we go. So we have two data grids. First one, second one, a custom control. So the data grids are here. That's easy for .NET developer. But the point here is, in the item source, we specify that this property will be used for binding. In the second data grid, we are going to use this. So that's the part that display, well, the application that display the suppliers. This one display the parts. So code behind is more important. Let's get here. That's the Civilite application here. And here we create this class, an instance of this class, part inventory model. And we use this object here as a data binding object, so we store that in the data context. And let's take a look at this. In some way, we call get parts on the view model. That's it. So user interface is very, very light, very low coupling. So let's move to the view model. View model is here. So in the view model, it's a class that implements the well-known iNotify property change interface. And somewhere you'll find the parts property, which is this. So return an observable collection of part item. And the other one, which is the suppliers, current part suppliers. So that's very easy. And somewhere we have a function that returns the parts. And in this function, get parts, we call the REST interface, the REST API, which is automatically generated. And we bind our REST object into the model, and we bind the model to the view. So that's very easy to follow. So if you have the time, I recommend you to take a look at the other implementation. So you have the Ajax implementation of this example. Let's find the parts with an ID starting with SKU1. You get something like this. You can edit inventory. You can get a list of suppliers. And you can do much more. So you can take a look at the code that uses client object model and this one that uses REST. But as you know, REST doesn't work in anonymous mode. So you cannot use that in public website. Okay, in the SPG, you'll find a lot of reusable libraries. Most of the reusable libraries are, of course, the service locator that provides service location, as I showed you before. Settings manager, if you want to store your settings in your farm in a scalable way. So don't store information in the webconfig, because the SP webconfig modification class doesn't work very well. Okay, but store that in a central location in the content database. And you can put that in cache. That's exactly what this component does. And also the SharePoint logger, which provides a way to easily log information in SharePoint. But you cannot use the SharePoint logger in the sandbox. So you can log, you cannot log information in the ULS in the sandbox. Okay. So if you want to log that in the sandbox, you have to log that in your farm in SharePoint list, for instance. And this is also illustrated in the SPG. Now we are going to move to the application lifecycle management and to the test part of this session. Karine?
Okay. Another part of the best practices, in fact, is proper application lifecycle management. The life cycle of an application starts with someone having a great idea on how to improve its productivity and ends not when the need is satisfied, but when the need becomes obsolete. The first step is to collect the business requirements and to translate it into a technical design. Normally, bigger applications are split into iterations. You will never, or rarely never, develop an application in the whole chunk. The application will be split into iterations, each iteration containing a predefined set of functionality. Each iteration is developed separately, deployed into test, and then deployed into production. When the development team starts developing, they can design unit tests, and they can run these unit tests in their proper environment. But for more specific tests, like integration tests, load tests, performance tests, it is best you have a separate test environment. After these tests are performed, there will be user acceptance phase. User acceptance is all about testing functional requirements. Some companies do these user acceptance tests on the same test environment. There are companies who do the user acceptance on different test environments. When the user accepts the iteration, it is deployed to production. But the development team will not wait until that first iteration is accepted. It will start developing the next iteration right away. But then, when users detect bugs, these bugs need to be fixed. So this means that part of the development team will start bug fixing, while the other part of the development team will continue including the new functionalities of the new iteration. Managing bug fixes and change requests is the most complex part of the application lifecycle. One of the best products to support application lifecycle management is Team Foundation Server. Previous versions of Team Foundation were already good in version control of source code, but Team Foundation Server 2008 and 2010 really proves how the product has matured and how it can embrace a complete application lifecycle. Business requirements are analyzed, and a technical architect will enter use cases or user stories into Team Foundation Server. So you can work or Agile or Scrum with Team Foundation Server. So the use cases are entered into Team Foundation Server and split in work items. In the meanwhile, the test team can start writing test scenarios and link these test scenarios to the work items. Then the development team comes in and starts developing. When checking in code, they can relate them to the work items already defined in Team Foundation Server. They can develop unit tests, and also these unit tests can be related to these work items. This way, you can manage or follow a business requirement from beginning to end. When an application is developed in iterations, there will be at a certain moment in time that you need to bug fix and develop the next iteration together. This means that your code will need to be branched and afterwards merged again to make sure that the new functionality and the bug fixes work together before it is deployed to the test environment. Team Foundation also allows for nightly builds, but with Team Foundation Server 2010, you can also deploy these nightly build results to a virtual environment. And this virtual environment is called Lab Management. In this virtual environment, you can do additional tests, like, for example, running all the unit tests that are available. Team Foundation Server offers different templates for different types of tests. You have a template for unit tests, templates for integration tests, and templates for performance tests, while in the meantime calculating code coverage and code metrics. The application lifecycle of a SharePoint application is a bit more complex. When you deploy a fresh SharePoint application for the first time, it will rarely fail. But once you start developing subsequent iterations, or need to bug fix or need to deploy bug fixes, you will have to manage your changes, especially if you have changes on content types, web parts, event receivers. If you don't manage those changes well, you can cause create awkward results. For example, if you have a content type and something that happened at ING, if you have changes to a content type and you don't manage those changes well, your content type can corrupt, meaning that the camel in your SharePoint hive is different from the schema XML stored in the content database. Well, the first rule in SharePoint application lifecycle management is develop features, develop solutions. Don't develop too much solutions, don't develop too less features. Combine your features into a solution based on functionality. Don't scatter your code around all the solutions. You can, in SharePoint 2007, you could already define feature dependencies. With 2010, you can also define solution dependencies. The version attribute on a future was already known in 2007, but it's only with 2010 that you can fully control a feature version change. In the feature receiver, we have a new method called feature upgrading. And at the other side, there are extra camel elements that can be used in the feature.xml to make the upgrade of a SharePoint feature more feasible. So the first element is version range. So this means that you can define different ranges and apply other actions dependent on the different version. Let's say you have a content type and you need to add certain you have to add new side columns. You can use the apply element manifest element to indicate which element.xml file to execute to deploy your new side columns. Use the add content type field element to specify which side column needs to be added to which existing content type. If that's not sufficient and you need to take other actions during deployment of your changes, you can define a custom action. A custom action is a string that can be captured in the feature upgrading event. When you test on it, you can execute the part of code that is listed under that custom action. And this combining version range and custom action gives you a powerful tool to manage upgrades of SharePoint applications. In the rest of the presentation, I will highlight one step in the application lifecycle management of an application, and that's unit testing. A unit test isolates a piece of code that tests a functional requirement. In most cases, you will have to develop more than one unit test to test that functional requirement. Let's say you're developing an online ticketing system where customers need to be 18 or older to watch a certain movie. In that case, you will have to write a unit test that tests a value higher than 18. You will have to write a unit test that tests a value lower than 18. And you will have to write a unit test that tests the value of 18 itself. Developing unit tests take a large amount of time, but a large of defects are identified during the run of unit tests. I am convinced that using unit tests and running unit tests starts to pay off once you start bug fixing your application. You fix a bug and you run your unit tests again. You will easily be able to verify if your fix is okay. But you will also be able to check if your bug fix didn't introduce new bugs, because that's often the case in developing applications. Another important part of unit testing is that normally you should run your unit tests into an isolated environment. And that is a problem with SharePoint. You are not able to run your unit tests on a SharePoint application in an isolated environment. There are objects like SP site that need a URL to a real existing SharePoint environment, otherwise the code will fail. Other objects don't have a public constructor, like, for example, SP event item properties. So in that case, you are not able to instantiate an object of that type. You can unit test applications using Visual Studio 2010. But Visual Studio 2010 came with a test project that allows unit testing for .NET Framework 4 applications. And we all know that SharePoint 2010 runs on the .NET Framework 3.5. But that is fixed with Service Pack 1. Service Pack 1 allows you to create unit tests on a .NET Framework 3.5 application. One of the new features of Visual Studio 2010 is IntelliTrace. This means that you can collect bugging information during the run of your unit tests. This information is collected in a log file, and you can use this log file afterwards to check what went on afterwards. But Visual Studio 2010 only offered support for 32-bit applications. And we all know that SharePoint 2010 is a 64-bit application. Also, this problem has been solved with Service Pack 1. It now supports IntelliTrace for 64-bit applications. This means that you can start unit testing your SharePoint applications to a certain limit. It doesn't provide for type mocking, so it doesn't provide for isolation of your SharePoint objects. For SharePoint 2007, there were third-party tools with which you could type mock your SharePoint objects. But with 2010, Microsoft wants to come with its own set of tools. And we talk about PEX and MOLS. Microsoft PEX is a Visual Studio add-in that you can install to create parameterized unit tests. A parameterized unit test is a test that has a certain amount of arguments in its signature. When running your unit test with PEX, PEX will pass that unit test several times. So, to come back on the example of the online ticketing service, PEX will run your unit test passing in a value higher than 18, passing in a value lower than 18, and passing in a value 18. So your test will be run at least 3 times with PEX. PEX is not only a Visual Studio add-in, it comes also with a command line utility, making able to include it in the nightly build. So you can, in fact, run your unit test using PEX during the nightly build. Another product is Microsoft MOLS, which allows you for type mocking the SharePoint objects. Not only SharePoint objects, you're also able to other environmental objects, but for this presentation, we are going to look at Microsoft MOLS mocking SharePoint objects. PEX and MOLS is not a complete major product at the moment. It's still in test phase. But you can download it from the Microsoft Research site and test it out. It's a kit that contains assemblies, code samples, and a lot of documentation. Microsoft PEX and MOS has been written by Peli de Halleu, and I want to mention that Peli is a Belgian developer, so he's someone we can be proud of. There's also a MSDN forum where you can ask your questions about PEX and MOS. Peli will respond almost immediately to your questions.
Less than 3 hours, huh?
Less than 3 hours, yeah, during the day, I suppose.
During the day, of
during
course.
The night, it will be less. What's a parameterized unit test? A parameterized unit test has a signature that accepts a number of arguments. And you can organize your test in 3 parts: a range, act, and assert. In the range part, you can instantiate your objects and add values to your properties. In the act part, you will execute the method under test. The assert part, you will assert, test, the value returned by your methods, and this will cause your unit test to fail or to pass. In simple methods, you will have only one assert, but in more complex methods, you can add more than one assert, and the more asserts you add, the more PEX will run your unit test. I'll give you a small demonstration on PEX. I have here an assembly, which is called ING Framework. It's only a start of a framework. It only shows that you can put certain code into a separate assembly that you can then reuse by other SharePoint projects. It can contain utility methods, it can contain extension methods, it can contain web controls, everything you think you can reuse during the SharePoint development.
Karin, ING is a fictitious company, right?
Yes, sure. I have here a model, and you can think of that model as a method of data access layer. This means that the presentation layer and the business layer perhaps will not know how it should. It needs information from SharePoint, but perhaps it does not know how to retrieve that information. And this is what the data access model knows. Do I need to retrieve data using the client object model? Do I need to use the web service? Or do I need to use a server object model? For simplicity, it only returns a string, but normally you could add their code that retrieves SharePoint information following the several client object models. To generate a unit test with PEX, I right-click the signature of the method, and I choose PEX, create parameterized unit tests. I accept all default settings in the first pop-up, but in the second, it will create my test project, so I will add something to it to create my project. And now PEX starts to creating the project and to create the unit test. When you see finished in here, your project will be created. You see the folder utilities because I made a PEX test, a unit test for utility method, and then I have my web utilities test class here, containing the unit test. Values will be passed in the signature of the method. So I will not do an arrange. I will not do an instantiation of objects. The only thing I will add is the assert of the result of my method. So what I'm going to test is if the string that is returned match the part of the enumeration that is executed. I get the name of the enumeration that is of the value of the enumeration that is passed in the signature, and I check it again. I verify it against the result coming back from my method under test. And now I will start running the unit test using PEX. So I do run PEX explorations. So this kicks off the unit testing with PEX, the exploration with PEX, but you will see that it takes a large amount of time. It takes a lot of time to run PEX unit tests, and it takes a lot of resources. That's one of the disadvantages of the tool. You will see here that the unit test will be executed several times. There will be several runs. So it did 4 runs with 100% code coverage. This bar indicates your code coverage. And you will see that it failed on the value web services. So you see PEX passed in the value server object model, client object model, and web services. On that last one, he failed. And that's because my method doesn't return the string web services, but web service. If I change this now to web services, then my test will pass. But before you can start running PEX again, you will have to deploy your assembly to the GAC. That's also a small disadvantage to it. You cannot build it, and PEX will not use it like it's built. You have to deploy it to the GAC before PEX can see your changes to the assembly. I have another method here. In my framework, it's again a utility method, and it's on the list utilities. It's a simple method that checks if a view exists on a list. If it exists, it will return true. If it doesn't exist, or if the passed in values are NULL, it will return false. Simple as that. I will again create a parameterized unit test using PEX. But I'll add it to the test project I already created. You will now see that I have a list utilities class. So what I can show you also is this was the web utilities test class PEX created. When he starts running the unit tests, the explorations, he creates another class which contains the different runs PEX makes. So you can check it out and see what he passes in. So my class list tests. You will see that it passes in a SP list. But as already said in my slide deck, I'm not able to type mock SharePoint objects using PEX. Therefore, I need moles. Also, moles is a Visual Studio add-in that you can use. The only thing you have to do is right-click your assembly and choose Add Moles Assembly. And that will mole your objects in this assembly. You can use moles with or without PEX. But if you decide to use it without PEX, you will have to create all the necessary unit tests yourselves. But it can completely separate it. So I will now start moling my list. So first of all, I need to add a reference to the moles assembly. In the documentation is mentioned that you will find the moles assemblies in the .NET tab, but I wasn't able to find them there. So you will have to retrieve that DLL from the files where PEX and moles are stored. So it's installed in the program files. When I go over to moles, you will see a directory moles assemblies, and there you will see a folder SharePoint moles. You see, moles is also, you can also use moles with SharePoint 2007, not only with SharePoint 2010. Okay.
And Visual Studio 2008 as well.
Yeah. Thank you. So I add a reference to that assembly. I'm going to pick it up from my recent tab because I already used it during my tests. Here is my moles assembly. I add a reference, and now I can start moling my SharePoint objects. Mole classes start with are prefixed with the letter M. So for SPList, I can create a mole using M SPList. But first, I need to tell my assembly that I want to replace all objects of type SPList with my mold type. So I execute the method behave as not implemented. But first, I have to add the using statement to my mold, for my mold. Okay. And then I can start moling. Moling SharePoint objects takes a certain amount of time, but I prepared a number of snippets to gain some time. So what I'm going to do is create a default view for my mold list. Once my mole is created, I forgot to add my... Voilà. Once my mole is created, I need to pass my mole to my SPList object. So, and now I can start running my unit test. I have to add an assert first. So I right-click my methods, and I say run PEX explorations. Again, PEX will try to run my unit test several times. But the run will fail, because I only added a default view to my mold list. And my unit, my test, my method, tests on the view collection. So I also need to mold my view collection. So every property and every method that is used in your methods, you have to mold. So this is the code to mold my view collection. And you will see that I create a view collection, a mold view collection, and create a view with a certain name. So I'll add a view name. Okay, and now I run my unit test using PEX explorations. It compiles and it starts running the unit test. PEX will pass in several values for my view, and you will see when passing in a null value, it failed. So I can add, it only run 3 times also, and my code coverage is about 85%. So I can add an extra assert if title equals 30 days, 2011. Then the result should be true. The result should be true, else the result should be false. So I run my unit test again. And you will see that PEX gets further. It will run more than 3 times this time. Still running, okay. Okay, and now you see these 2 tests he already did previous time, but now he added a string tech days 2011. So the more asserts you add, the more times PEX will run your unit test passing in different values, achieving higher code coverage. At the other side, I have also an extension method on the content type collection, which tests if a certain content type exists. Also for this one, I will create a unit test using PEX. But if I have to start mocking all the SP content type collection, I will have to add a lot of code. To avoid this, okay, I'm going to create it. To avoid this, the MOLS kit also includes a behavior set. It's part of the MOLS project is behaviors.samples.zip file. And when you unzip it, you will have the Microsoft SharePoint Behaviors DLL. This assembly contains a lot of SharePoint mold objects with moles. It does not include all SharePoint objects, nor it doesn't include all SharePoint properties or methods, but I think about 80% is covered by that project. So what you have to do is open that project in Visual Studio, compile it, you have your behaviors DLL with behave types, and you can use it during your unit tests.
It also covers Link to SharePoint. So there is
yes,
a mole implementation of Link to SharePoint
yeah,
as well.
That's true.
If you want to unit test your repository yeah. pattern.
Okay. I generated a unit test for this one. You will see an additional folder extensions is created, and here you find my content type extensions test method with a PEX method for my extension method. I also prepared a snippet for this. So what does the snippet do? It creates, it first tells my code that I want to replace all instances of SP content type collection with a mold object. So I have to add first a using statement. The behavior DLL is not added yet as a reference, so I'll add it also. And I'll add a using statement to it also. Okay. Mold types start with the letter M, or prefixed with the letter M, followed by the exact name of the object. Behave types are prefixed with the letter B, and then following the complete, the exact name of the SharePoint object. The only thing you have to do is create a new object of that behaved type and pass in the behavior that you want. You set values to the properties that are tested in your methods, and you, yeah, you set the behavior for those properties. You create the necessary items so that it mimics the behavior of your objects under test. And then you execute your methods. And then the asserts follow. So this way, you work with behave types. I run it. So as already mentioned, the project of the behave types is not completely encoded. There are moles that are missing. Or you can add them to the project itself, because you have the source code in your hand. You have the source code deployed on your machine. Or you mold type yourself. So that's about unit testing using PEX and moles.
Did we mention that all these tools work as command line as well? So we can
yeah.
integrate that in
yeah.
the build server if you want to use that on the TFS build server. Then we can move to the conclusion. So we recommend you to adopt a more layered approach to your SharePoint development. So, and to do that, we recommend you to focus on the main patterns described by the SPG. So accustom yourself with the SPG, with the reference application, try the test solution. So the PEX and MOL framework is also used in the SPG, so you can see how that works, how to do that in the real world. The SPG also provides a set of integration tests, not just unit tests as well.
Start using the feature upgrading event. If you're developing for SharePoint 2010, start using the feature upgrading event because it allows you for proper SharePoint application management. Use Microsoft PEX to create your unit tests. This way you will have less unit tests to create, and start using moles to type mock your SharePoint objects.
And also integrate the cloud, which means today Office 365, into your governance plan. Make sure that your code today can run in the cloud in the future. If it doesn't, you have to justify why and how to fix that in the future in your governance plan. That's super, super important. So stay up to date with MSDN Belix. Here are the different references to the MSDN Belix website, so the Twitter, the Facebook. All this session will be available on Channel 9 next week. And you can download all the slides and all the demo if you want. We will be at the Ask the Expert booth,
yes,
so we can later. Continue the session
yeah.
later on if you want, if you have more questions. And, well, thank you and see you later.
Thank you very much.